Welcome to the Food Matters Live podcast, where we showcase the innovations, the big ideas, and the visionaries in the food industry. We dig deep, we look to the future and the past, and we question everything we think we know about food. I'm Anthony Zara, and this episode was recorded live at the Food Matters Live event held at London's Olympia. This episode is all about global flavours.
My name is Gertie Royal. I am a food writer and a trends expert, but my background is actually in food innovation. I was at Harrods for many years as head of marketing for food, restaurants and wine. Before that, I was at Innocent Drinks in the marketing and development team, and then I was also head of food trends for M&S for a couple of years as well. So that's my background. And also, I do a lot of writing. I write for Olive Magazine, I write for Waitrose, and global flavour is my area of expertise. Great.
Fab. I am Jaimini Sharma. I'm from Tesco. I'm lucky enough to lead the grocery development team at Tesco. I've been at Tesco for 10 years. So the grocery team is incredible and the home of global cuisine as we know it. So great to be talking to you all today.
Great. Good to be here. Look forward to chatting about flavour a lot. My name is Matt McAuliffe. I'm the Brand and Futures Innovation Director at the Complete Food Group. If you're not aware of Complete, which isn't a surprise, we look after brands and I'm responsible for brands like Unearthed, Vadas, which is our pickles and ferment, Squeaky Bean, more traditional pastry items. So there's a lot of talk of flavour all the time, but also the futures side of things as well. So staring into the dark future, trying to decide what's next. So look forward to chatting with you today.
So that's a really good segue into my first question for you both, is when you're trying to predict flavours, how far ahead do you actually look? And what is the key driver of these timelines? I assume packaging, but is there anything else? I'd be really interested to kind of get your take on that.
Yeah. I can go first. I think for me, there's three key buckets when we think about looking ahead for flavours. There's almost what's happening now, what's emerging, and then almost what's coming up next. And I think you can identify flavours, but it's about landing with the right timing, because I think often you identify flavours and you get really excited about them, but actually they can be too early for their time. So it's about making sure you're identifying what the flavour is, but actually how do you translate that into a really accessible way that customers are going to understand and sort of scale it when at the optimum opportunity that it's going to resonate, rather than kind of trying to bring it in too early.
Can you give any specific examples of a flavour that you put out that might have been too early? I don't know if you want to talk about any products in particular.
Yeah, I can think of a couple. So I think an example of a flavour would be miso, right. I think could be a really good example. So we all know miso in the kind of traditional sense within kind of Asian cuisine. We saw that starting to emerge in desserts, as an example, in caramels and panna cottas, etc. Probably didn't resonate in the way that we would have liked, because it was a couple of years ago that we launched that, and I think it was slightly too early. But it's almost taken those learnings. It's very much still a flavour that's still around, and how do we educate customers in terms of why we're using that ingredient, how it pairs, and also sometimes it's using the ingredients but not necessarily to call it out. So to use the ingredients to enhance the flavour and enhance the product, but not necessarily making a big flash of it on the product description or on pack, that it feels scary and inaccessible.
Almost tell them afterwards.
Exactly.
This is why you like to say
exactly.
Matthew, how about you? What, how far ahead do you look, and what drives those timelines?
Unsurprisingly, similar to how you guys work, we have a now, next, and future approach to all of our trends. We've got this. I brought this today because it's our new trend document, and in there we talk about flavour quite a lot. And it's built around tensions and the fact that you've got one that called the global citizen, where we seem to have just this inundation of global flavors. And then you've got the opposite, the tension with one called home heartland, which again, it's not like a horrible reform based, let's just eat fish and chips forever. It's the opposite. It's the National Trust. It's Desi pubs or Cypriot fish and chip shops. Isn't our culture in the UK amazing? So you look at all of those trends and overlay things as well. Like third culture seems to be something that comes out more. People who don't relate to the country they live in or their parents' homeland or their parents' passport or anything. So it's such a fluid, I think it's brilliant at the same time because you can play with things where in the past you can't and you couldn't. But as far as failed launch, I think Induya would be my perfect example. And Rosie and myself used to work together. We've been selling that forever. It's only just stuck. That's been like an overnight success that's taken 10 years,
basically.
And now we're drying it and sprinkling it on things and everything.
Well, we'll come on to a bit more about that sort of stuff. But with all of these different, I suppose, sort of worlds of flavor colliding all the time, how do you actually track and monitor them? Do you have a process? Is it something that you're actively going out doing? Is it just about being on Instagram all day? Like what do you have tools that you use that you come back to? What is the actual tracking for you both?
I think it's like a heady cocktail of insight, foresight. There's some know-how because there's some experience that we've got for working in the business as long as we have done. And then there's some instinct as well.
Yeah.
But also it depends on, you know, if you're McDonald's, they've just gone live with a sriracha mayo for the first time. Like, we're all over sriracha, aren't we? We've moved on. So it depends on your business and your customer on what's right. You know, hot honey would be maybe right for a Wall sausage roll, but we wouldn't use it anywhere else in our brands.
Yeah. Okay.
So there's a kind of focus and timing side of things as well.
Okay. How about a Tesco?
Yeah, I would say it's... You can be inspired. I love this space. I think you could be inspired in it everywhere. For me, is inspiration. So yes, social media, TikTok, etc. But also chefs, restaurants, menus, traveling. I think you can look everywhere. But I think for me, it's around connecting those points together. So I think one of those in isolation it doesn't quite resonate in the same way as almost connecting those dots.
Yeah.
And I think when you start to see flavor trends crop up across all of those platforms, that's when it becomes exciting and that's when it becomes something that you think, actually, you can translate this into something that will resonate for a customer, into a product for their Tuesday night weekly meal almost.
Yeah.
I think we've just launched an example that's kind of front of mind. We've just launched a barbacoa cooking sauce. And that for me is an example of, we know that Latin American and kind of that cuisine, elevated Mexican is really trending. We're seeing loads of restaurants open up in that space. And it's about how do we understand and take that learning that's almost insight driven, what customers are doing, what we're seeing opening up in the market, and translate that into a product that is really easy and accessible for customers. Yeah. So without overcomplicating it, to almost help them integrate that kind of cuisine into their daily repertoire and daily meals almost to create that scale.
Yeah.
But without oversimplifying it, so you lose the authenticity. It's a bit of a balance.
And so from a process perspective, do you have dedicated flavor trends teams, or is it something that is just a part of the everyday work of your developers, or is it built into an insight function? Lots of different businesses do it different ways. I was at M&S and I was the head of food trends. My job was to do that.
Yeah.
It's interesting to hear how that happens at different businesses.
Yeah. So from our point of view, we do a bit of both. So it's kind of a 2-3-pronged approach. So we have a product direction team who come and share trends with us, and they are fed into from lots of different organizations. So think people like the Food People, etc., global trends that I'm sure everybody is looking at. I'm sure you guys look at those same sort of trends. And then we also have category specific trends, because I guess from a grocery perspective, the trends that we're seeing are very different to what they see in like prepared foods, as an example. So I think you almost overlay what's happening at a sort of macro level, and then you also overlay what that means for your category. And that can be anything from what's happening in the health space, what's happening in terms of new packaging formats, what's happening with new ingredients, etc. And then it's almost a bit of a melting pot of us take in all of that insight and information and almost translating that into a product that we know is going to resonate with customers.
How about you, Matthew?
Yeah, I think
who made your trends book?
We've done it a team internally.
Right.
There's a couple of us on the future side, so Lady Cook, Catherine, and myself. We had some external help in pulling it together, and we've got a really broad insight function. They're very good at looking at what's selling at the moment rather than kind of peering into the future. So it's been a process of kind of fine-tuning that kind of forward-looking lens. But I'm also a believer in things find you. If you work, you become a bit of a magnet, don't you? Stuff kind of like, I have a bit of an unwritten rule around, if you see things three times in various different media, you might read an article in somewhere like Vittles, there'll be something on TV, and then somebody will leave something on your desk, and you're like, hang on a minute, there's something happening here, basically. Yeah. So there's that instinct I'd like to think is really, really important for this as well.
And I agree, it's quite a fine balance between looking at the data to understand what could sell, but then that doesn't tell you anything about what might be able to sell with a new flavor. So how do you, what for you becomes the tipping point? We've kind of touched on it a little bit. Is there a certain thing where you're like, okay, now we think it's reached the tipping point from niche into something we're ready? And do you, when you're introducing a new flavor, will you put that into testing before you launch it? Is there much insight into sort of consumer acceptance of an ingredient, or will you sort of just take the punt, go for it, and put stuff out there and see what happens? Is it a bit of both?
I think this is, for me, where there's a bit of like almost natural tension where you're...
Good tension, always.
But I think where you're not diluting the authenticity of a product, but you do need to make sure that it translates so that customers understand it. And I think it's getting the balance right. So you'll have a product where there's specific flavor cues or ingredient cues that you know that product needs to have to, in order to kind of measure up against what customers recognize it for. But it also needs to be scalable and accessible and able to be used. So it becomes kind of that everyday basket purchase. So it's a balance of both. So an example I'd use is like a barbecue sauce. The wood smoke that it's the flavor is, you know, you call out on pack. You wouldn't compromise on that oak, hickory, you know, flavor notes, but you might say actually, from a textural point of view, or in terms of the way that you add that sweetness or the texture, you would potentially compromise on that. So it's about understanding by product and by range, what are those authenticity cues that customers are going to buy into the range for, and not compromising on those, and then almost having a bit of a view on actually what is less important and what's not going to resonate with customers, and that's how you make it scalable. I don't know if you had a different view.
And it's so hard to kind of second guess what the consumer, you know, ultimately we're all customers as well. We're all very different. Second guessing what they want is a kind of de-risking job, to be honest. There's loads of testing platforms out there that you can ask, and it depends on how you pose the question on what answer you're going to get. It shouldn't ever be a way of making decisions. It should just be about building rationale to make you feel more comfortable. You know, if you've got one SKU to launch and you've got three flavors, which flavor do you go live with first? It's quite a tough decision. Yeah. Or if you've got a range, you'll probably go safe, and then you'll go for one wild card just to go and test the water and have products swimming around in the back ready to go. It's always quite a toughie. Again, it's like consumer, even by retailer, what will sell in Tesco's will be very different from what will sell in M&S and Waitrose. Yeah. There's a science to this. The consumer, that insight and all of that testing kind of help you through. But even then, there's still a horrible risk of it being a disaster.
Always. Just to build on that, you mentioned around insight, etc. And that's absolutely the route that we're going down, is trying to do as much testing as we can with product titles, with ingredients, with formats, with packaging, etc. to test with customers and ask them, is this something that's going to be usable? Is it something that you're going to understand, etc. to give us a bit of a gauge before we launch. Now, it's never going to tell you everything, but it gives you a good indication on whether that's something that is going to resonate.
So let's come on to actual cuisines. I'd love to know a bit more about what global cuisines you're sort of monitoring or tracking at the minute. And I think for me, what's most interesting with this is, are there cuisines that you believe have now crossed into the mainstream? Because I think for me, that's the most exciting thing with trends, is that you get to a point where something has jumped the gun and crossed into mainstream. And generally people like, for me, it's people like Pret Itsu and McDonald's are the gauges of whether I think something's crossed into the mainstream. Yeah. Are there the cuisines that, you know, you would say they're almost not a trend and consumers, we're ready to play with them as part of the mainstream now? And then what are those couple of cuisines that you're looking ahead to maybe 2 or 3 years?
Kimchi would be the perfect kind of flavor profile for me. Like we just launched some kimchi in 2 products with Pret. And you talk about Pret being that barometer. It is amazing because they're doing really well. There's an acceptance for kimchi. Kimchi is one of those things that it doesn't matter who, if you ever speak to anybody in our business that tells you, yeah, I saw kimchi, rubbish. We back pickles. We were blown away by kimchi's rate of sale, basically, because we were in the right place at the right time with the right brand and the right product. And there was a pent-up demand for fermented foods. Badass is not a Korean brand. It is not an authentic brand. It's a flavor brand. So that time, there was no data to say, get into kimchi. There was a lot of gut instinct around digestive wellness and building health and vegetables and things like that that made us feel comfortable. But that's the perfect example of a flavor profile that, hang on a minute, it's in Pret, but only 4% of fridges have a pot of kimchi in them in this country. There's zero, you know, from a penetration perspective, if you think olives is about 25, hummus is about 90, there's a load more fridges to have fermented vegetables in. So the fact that Pret have gone, it seems to have happened quicker than normal, basically. It's astounding the speed that we churn through.
Yeah. Well, I suppose with Pret, those pink pickled onions have been in products for a while, haven't they? So there is almost this sort of sense of they've been taking their consumers on that sort of interesting pickled journey subliminally almost, because they popped about 4 or 5 years ago and suddenly they were in all their sandwiches. So they're kind of getting there.
Everything's better with pickles.
Everything's better. So kimchi Korean is one, would you say has crossed over into the mainstream, or is one that you're now, you think consumers have an acceptance of?
I think it is, again, you know, for every complaint we get saying your kimchi is not authentic, we get a letter, somebody saying your kimchi reminds me of the 8 years I spent in Korea. Like what is kimchi? We could spend the whole day talking about that, and that would be fascinating. So there's a, what is kimchi? Our product is a gateway kimchi, to be honest. I think we've got a hot and chunky one that's funkier and has got a kind of feeder in there made of pear. It's a gateway kimchi, and that's what people want. They want introductions to these flavors that suddenly open them up. Sure. If you go straight to something that's full of fish sauce and is quite funky, it puts people off.
So that's it, because that brings up, I suppose, an interesting question when you say a gateway, because actually kimchi in itself can be a gateway into lots of things. Firstly, it could be a gateway into more chili pickles. It could be a gateway into more Korean ingredients, so gochujang and other things like that. Or it could be a gateway into more gut health things. So are you looking at all those things together? Or when you see something like kimchi doing well, do you kind of go, well, that's because of Korean food? Or do you just look at it in isolation as that ingredient?
It's more around... Fadas is a flavor brand, and we provide super condiments that make everything taste better.
Yeah.
So that gives us a bonkers playing field, basically. Smack cucumbers would be the most recent example where you see it on loads of menus. Again, it's that is now the right time. We've launched it's doing well because people are like, oh, smack cucumbers, I've heard about those, or they're on every menu. So it gives us a playing field that we could go into. Who's to say we couldn't go down a pot of 60 gram tin Spectre says we need to eat 60 grams of kimchi every day. Here's your medicinal. Because, you know, it's a pretty amazing product from that perspective. So we're not hemmed in with Vadas, which is a bigger problem than it sounds. Because we're like, oh my God, we could do anything. Basically, should we do cheese? That's fermented. You know, it's crazy. Yeah. So that can also be a problem.
Okay. And I think to your point, I think it could do all of those jobs. Right. But I guess it's almost how do we make sure that we educate customers and tell customers, actually, you could buy this because it adds a load of flavour. It's really good for your gut and it's without feeling confusing for customers that they can use it in different ways. But for me, that's an education piece because the product's already doing all of those jobs.
So Tesco, what cuisines do you think have crossed over into the mainstream and what ones are you watching at the moment? Or it could be ingredients.
I think similar to what Matt was sharing around kind of Korean, Pan-Asian, it feels like it's definitely getting bigger. So I think we have dabbled a little bit in Pan-Asian, but I think there's loads more opportunity. Korean also, from a health perspective, but also in terms of, more everyday sort of dishes for customers to recreate, from a scratch cook perspective specifically. But also I mentioned earlier around the evolution of Mexican. So I think in the UK market, it's very much around Tex-Mex, your enchiladas, your fajita kits. But it's what's beyond that. Yeah. You know, when you look at restaurants, Oaxaca, Tempa, you see the barbacoa, you see the birria coming through. We've dabbled a little bit of that. I don't know if people in the room have seen our Chef's Collection range, where we've started to introduce some of those flavour profiles. But it's evolving the cuisines that we know are really established that customers are familiar with and they trust and almost taking them on a bit of a journey.
I think that's really interesting because I think one of the things with trends overall is that actually, yes, there are these new emerging cuisines, but actually there's a real deep dive into cuisines that people love and know. Yeah. So with Mexican, going beyond your generic Tex-Mex, but going into regionality. With Indian, instead of it being Indian, it being Kerala'n or Goa'n or whatever. Exactly. And even with Chinese, you know, the sort of breaking it down to Szechuanese or Cantonese. Yeah. I think for me, that is one of the interesting sort of things. And on the one hand, we're more interested in more cuisines. But on the other hand, we're wanting this real granularity of the cuisines that are kind of known and loved. Italian as well, for example, I think.
Absolutely.
It's really, really interesting to kind of see that.
And I think that the economic landscape also plays a role because customers are still quite risk averse. You know, they don't want to commit to spending a whole load of money on products that they're not sure whether it's going to deliver and they're not that familiar with. So I think grounding it with a cuisine that they know about, but keeping it exciting in a new format. We always talk about it at Tesco, and I'm sure you guys do this as well, but in terms of if you're having a new ingredient or a new flavour, have a more accessible format and vice versa. If you're going to experiment a bit more with a format, keep the flavour really accessible so it doesn't feel too sort of scary. And once you get, hopefully, then a trial purchase, then customers are going to come back and repeat, and therefore it drives your scale.
I think, and that's one thing that M&S I think is really good at, in that they, although the flavors seem really out there sometimes, the formats are incredibly safe.
Yes,
the packaging is incredibly engaging, and often they're leading with the discussion of actually how does it sensorially taste versus the actual ingredient itself.
Yes.
One of the phrases they used to use a lot was safe twist.
Okay.
Which was kind of interesting, which is always to say, never go safe twist, because it's too far for the customer.
Yeah.
But actually safe twist, having one thing that feels like it's progressive is enough.
So exciting,
And actually, this is another question for you guys. When you're looking at global flavors, how are there certain ranges or certain products or certain categories that you think are sort of safer, and are there occasions that you would never touch? Like, for example, would you ever introduce a new flavor at Christmas? Like, or do you think that's too protected as a kind of area of development? Like, what are your thoughts on categories or product groups that are particularly receptive to new flavors? Aside from crisps.
Aside from, damn. Yeah, let's face it. It's always the best aisle. Doesn't matter what country you go to.
Crisps is always the best aisle. Yeah. I think we've got. I think you kind of know where customers want to experiment, and it does tend to be CSN, Crisps, Nuts and Nuts. It does tend to be on those kind of more impulse buys, things like what you mentioned, Christmas, hot chocolates, you know, seasonally relevant products where customers are willing to experiment a bit more rather than your sort of day-to-day weekly meal plan. It does feel like it's driven more seasonally. So if it's sort of Halloween and you want a new home bake kit because you're having a Halloween party or a football World Cup party, it feels topical, you know, you're more willing to want to experiment and buy into a new product, whether it's a new flavour or a new format. So for me, it's sort of seasonally and topical driven versus category driven, right, if that makes sense. Yeah. It's almost relevant to kind of the season and what's relevant at the time.
And
I think there are brands of us, a brand like Unearth, for instance, where we've got the Mediterranean for a playground. That I doubt we're going to run out of flavour inspiration for a while, even though the consumer wants that reminder of holidays and something that's a little bit safer. If you look at what's happening, you know, when we're planning our now next future, North Africa, we've dabbled and played with food from with a Moroccan inspiration. But Tunisian food is amazing at the moment. Yeah. Who's the lady, Bouthina? There's a cafe called Oula. Brick, harissa, all these crazy Tunisian sandwiches. So I'm sure, you know, we tend to be, and this is the problem, we pile it all in as Middle Eastern, just like I've done with Mediterranean, when actually you can go down a country-specific route. Look at, you know, if you've been lucky enough to go to Impala, I'd like to think I know a bit about flavour and names and foods. I've never been on Google so often on that menu, basically. Malakia, jute and fatira, there's so many things. That inspiration, we're never going to run out, are we, basically? And that's the brilliant thing about the world in which we operate in. But it's, you know, which one next? Yeah. When are we going to jump on, you know, harissa? Yeah. You know, most people don't know that harissa comes, actually its origins are in Tunisia. Yeah. So there's some stories that we need to tell about the origins of these products and make sure that we stick to that and use it again as education.
But I mean, on Mediterranean, I think for me, the explosion of Greek and Turkish has been incredible, like extraordinary, like and amazing. And I love it for that exact reason, and that people are really getting into the kind of the nitty-gritty, and actually before that would have been clumped together as kind of a bit on the side of Mediterranean,
Eastern Med,
exactly. They dump some feta in, whatever. Yeah. But now is a real there's a real sort of desire for those sorts of flavors, and actually getting into the regionality of that. Greek in particular, I think, has been quite an explosion recently. How much of a role does sort of food safaris, travel, going to restaurants, like, is that still a big part of what your developers are doing? Or is it something that is kind of the nice to have? Does it still inform a lot of your development and the flavours that you begin to incorporate?
Yeah, I would say, massively. I think without that, it's so difficult to understand what's going on in the market in terms of techniques, in terms of ingredients, in terms of pairings, all of that sort of stuff. So I think We do, you know, the teams go out and they travel, they visit expos, they look at menus, they eat out at restaurants, etc. But what we do is make sure that we're targeting them versus the trends that we're seeing, projects that we're working on, etc. So it all kind of then marries together. So we do lots of travel. We're lucky enough to do lots of travel and sort of bring them back. We then share those with the wider business and then understand how do we translate those into the different categories, because there'll be bits that might be relevant for desserts over here, bakery over there, and then prepared foods over there. So it's almost just taking the bits that are there relevant for your category.
And are there places in particular? I mean, for me, Amsterdam, South Africa, Australia, and the States have been always generally the places. Are they still the places that you look to, or are there, when you're looking at other retailers, I suppose, for example, or are there other places, are you now going specifically to the countries themselves? Is it a mix of both?
Yeah. I think all of the countries that you mentioned are massive in terms of leading, I would say, even places within the Middle East, Dubai, as an example. They've got the cool avocado scanners, which tell you how ripe they are. Things like technology in stores, merchandising in stores, not just products and flavors. But also, Europe was so lucky. Italy's kind of on our doorstep in terms of informing for pizza, bread, Italian meals. That's massive for us in grocery, pasta, sauces, etc. The Mediterranean. So we get lots of inspiration from going to the countries themselves. I think the only other thing I would say is it's really key for us to translate that thinking for so that it's relevant for the UK market and the UK customer, because what you see out there isn't always going to land.
Yeah.
So it's almost marrying that up against what we're seeing from a restaurant culture, because that's more in line with, I guess, what customers are expecting from that cuisine, because that's what they're sort of used to. So it's almost bringing both parts together and landing in a way that we think we know that's going to land.
Cool. Matthew?
Yeah, look. Restaurants, whenever it comes up, restaurants and chefs, shout out to those guys, because who'd want to be in that industry now? We've got to do everything we can to protect them, because I don't know what I'd do without that inspiration and them translating, whether it's food cultures or coming up with crazy ideas that we'd never thought of that we now want to put together. So we need to make sure we protect that. I think it's not just swanky restaurants either. If you want to learn about Dominican or Peruvian or Bolivian food, take a walk down the Walworth Road, basically, and in every place. And you'll probably come across an Algerian bakery as well that's just incredible. So I think it's not just swanky, put your napkin down stuff. There's lots of real food out there. Travel is just amazing, isn't it? I'm going to Athens. I've never been to Athens before. I'm going in a couple of weeks' time at the end of a holiday. I'm looking forward to immersing myself in Greek food for a few weeks. Travel is amazing. We've got 95 suppliers in Europe, so you can go and visit them and they'll serve you something, or they make something that you never knew existed. The Andouille supplier, they've literally started dehydrating it and use it as a seasoning that you just sprinkle on everything. And it's like, wow, we need to sell that. Or you go to a supermarket in Denmark and see loads of different cucumbers. Like, who'd have known Denmark love cucumbers of different varieties and protected varieties? So travel is critical. But you are right about the translating it to the UK. Those suppliers and partners we have in Europe, quite often they think, why can't you just go and sell this? And it's like, well, it's a mortadella made of liver and kidneys. It's just a non-starter for Go. So there's that cultural lens as well, isn't there?
Yeah.
So that leads on nicely to the next question. When you're looking at these flavours that you're bringing over, introducing, how do you retain that balance between being true to the authenticity of the ingredient and the story and the culture it's from, and also translating it? And I mean, there are the words cultural appropriation, which do always come into this sort of stuff. How are you sensitive to that, and how do you strike that balance?
So I think, I feel like we have a really important role to play in this as a retailer, because we are representing the food culture. So it is really important that we stay authentic to what we're trying to deliver, but equally, simplify it enough so that it's translatable for customers. It feels accessible and they feel excited by it, but it doesn't feel too alienating and too scary. So it is a real balance. And I mentioned that kind of tension earlier, but it is that, for me, that balance of making sure it's authentic, that customers do feel sort of excited, but not oversimplified.
And so when you say authentic there, do you mean in terms of the actual product, in terms of the way you're positioning it, where you're sourcing it from, the way you're doing the storytelling? Like, what for you do you mean by that word when you say that?
I think it's almost a combination of everything. So I think it's a combination of the method, that the way that the product's made, the ingredients that are being sourced, the supply chain, etc. But also when you are storytelling, whether that's on pack, it's being, we used a lot of inspired by or influenced by, because often, we won't go into kind of technicalities, but it, often from a technical perspective, it is really challenging to deliver that product as authentically or as traditionally you would find it in wherever, whichever country kind of that's inspired by. So we tend to use a take influenced by perspective when we land.
Yeah. It's important to retain the heritage when you're talking about products. And we talk, you know, as I mentioned about Harissa, that's a fascinating story. So it's important that you can convey those stories. I think when it comes to sourcing products from different parts of the world, I struggle sometimes with the terminology around style, Spanish style, yeah, Persian style, and terms like that, because that's already a bit of a kind of pointer that maybe nobody's got a clue what Persian style is. It's just like, what is that?
What does it mean for customers?
People need to ask themselves, you know, so if you see the word style, I tend to be a little bit, that's a bit strange. But also, you know, again, I don't want to drone on about Vadas, but it's a Hungarian name. The brand was started by Nick, whose grandparents left Hungary in the revolution. He makes kimchi, sauerkraut and pickles. I think there's, again, where's the authenticity there? What's that? There is a link. There's a historical lineage to making pickles and a culture that relies on it. So I think there's some fluidity there that it would be a real shame if we don't allow that, this melting pot and cross-reference, because we're pretty amazing at that in this country as well, where we are, you know, it was put to me once that France, the food culture in France and Spain and Italy is a bit like a kind of 40-year-old woman or man. They're kind of experienced. They know what they like. It's all a bit the same in history. Where in the UK, we're like a teenage boy or girl. We're just like, put that. Oh, wow, that's amazing. Bored of that now. Let's move on to the next thing.
Yeah.
And that in itself is an amazing culture that we've created here as well. So I don't think we should be shy of that borrowing. We just have to doff our cap when we're doing it, basically.
Do you have different approaches with new flavours for sweet versus savory things? Do you think you're more adventurous with sweet? Like, is there a different process with, do you think because customers are more accepting in certain sweet or savory? Is that a lens that you're sort of considering?
I would say no, actually. Okay. I think we look at trends sort of overall.
Right.
So there are flavours that marry into both sweet and savoury. Like we mentioned, miso,
yeah,
things like hot honey, as an example, lend themselves to both. I think there's some flavours that are more relevant for some than others. Harissa is probably a really good example. But we would look at kind of flavour trends more broadly and then see where in and if it's relevant for which area. For example, if we're looking at a flavour trend that's relevant for sweet, it might be relevant in sweet bakery, but not necessarily
right,
dessert.
Yeah.
So I think it's a bit of category specific, but also a bit of, you know, more broadly,
yeah,
where can we apply it rather than let's specifically look at one area.
Sure.
But there will therefore be, and I mentioned this earlier, there will be trends that come out that are specific to product types and product areas, which we will also then explore that won't necessarily resonate,
yeah,
you know, across the portfolio.
Yeah.
A bit both.
Matthew?
Yeah, because it goes both ways. Like, I love miso in a, give me a cookie with some miso,
yeah,
in, and it's like killer. It's also translating sweet and savoury across. I've got a bit of a thing about savoury cheesecakes at the moment. Like, you can make amazing, like, quiches. We make a lot of quiches. They're a bit dull, aren't they, quiches?
Not the Tesco ones.
Not the Tesco's ones, obviously. Particularly the, yeah, definitely. But they're as a format, they're a bit old-fashioned. But if you call it, like, a savoury cheesecake and do something interesting. So formats work across sweet and savoury. The bit I'd love to crack is getting a bit more fruit into salads and antipasti and things like that. That I think there's some scope for us all to kind of work on. Because if you think about all the cuisines of the Med, there's always fruit. There's always fruit in there.
Yeah.
You know, give me a char-grilled nectarine and burrata and stuff like that. So I think there's some work that we can do on translating fruit across.
Right.
As well as that. I'd love to see that a bit more.
Yeah. So aside from the ingredients that you've mentioned, the miso, kimchi, are there sort of two or three ingredients that have surprised you that consumers have just been really absolutely loving? And are there a couple of ingredients that you're playing with that you can tell us about?
I've got sown with so many failures. It's unbelievable. I think we've had a cracker like seaweed in a number of different formats, and that's always failed, whether it's a, you know, a kind of whack-a-me seaweed salad or seaweed flavored olives or something like that. We've struggled to get the kind of cut through from that perspective, which is a bit of a shame.
Yeah, that's so delicious.
Yeah. That would be top of the... Let me have a think about a couple more.
Yeah.
Well, it's your go.
Yeah, I can think of a few. We've tried a couple. I mean, this isn't that wild, but we've tried a couple of sort of named chilies which haven't resonated because they're just too stretching. They're too far-fetched. Customers don't get it. So rather than creating, we call them RTVs at Tesco, reasons to believe, in terms of what the quality cues are for a product, is rather than us... taking something that we believe is a almost premium ingredient, is almost stripping that back, and rather than it being a specific ingredient, we think about what's going to land with customers, what are they going to understand, and what are they going to be excited by. So I think there's a list as long as my arm of products and ingredients that we've tried that haven't kind of resonated.
And what are you playing with in your development in kitchens at the moment? Is there something that you're playing with that you're hoping consumers will enjoy in the next 1 or 2 years?
Yeah, I think again, we've used a blanket term around the Middle East, basically. Like, what, you know, again, we could fill a whole session and you could get people who know a lot more than I do to come in and talk about the intricacies of Middle Eastern food and how we can delve a little bit more deeply than, oh, there's some pomegranates, must be Middle Eastern. So I think there's some development there, again, coming back to the Med and Unearthed. It's just such a rich seam. And we've talked about, you mentioned Italy, if you just focused on a Sicilian range or something there, that you could really go deep into something. I'd like to see more explorations around the world. I love the idea of South America and Latin America. The same with Africa. You know, we've got some amazing restaurants in London. And again, there's some amazing places in South London, but we don't know anything, basically. We're not right, you know, I've worked in food for too long and I know absolutely nothing. So I think there's, you know, we're not going to run out of ideas, definitely.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think it's, like you say, the established cuisine that we touched on earlier and how we evolve those further that customers already have the confidence in. So evolving Italian as an example, and also creating products in line with the way people are eating. I think particularly approaching the kind of summer season where we know people are doing more alfresco dining, sharing plates and eating in a different sort of way. It's how do we create products that match that? Yeah. So we've just launched actually a range of pasta dressings. So rather than your traditional pasta sauces, it's how do we evolve that into a pasta dressing? Yeah. So it's suitable for hot and coldy. Yeah. It's suitable for a pasta salad. It can be drizzled on a pizza, etc. Right. And evolving cuisines that customers already know and are excited by, but also, like you mentioned, sort of the Greek, the Mediterranean. How do we tap into that more style, the cuisine, but also that style of eating in terms of pack size, packaging, table ready, you know, all of that sort of stuff. And also health is massive. And I know that's slightly separate from kind of global, but the way that sort of Mediterranean, well, all of the kind of European products are very clean in terms of, and very minimal in terms of their ingredients. How do we learn from that and think about how we build our recipes differently?
Yeah.
Great.
Because you mentioned health, because that's a brilliant reason to add more flavor as well. Take the salt out, add salt, add spicing, add herbs, drive flavors, make things lighter to be more appropriate for all the craziness that's going on in the health sphere and GLP-1s. That allows us something to play with. Yeah. I'd like to see a bit more kind of interesting breakfasts as well. I don't know about anyone. I'm like, breakfast boredom is like well and truly set in. Bit of kind of inspiration from around the world on breakfast would be would be amazing as well.
Yeah, agree.
Nice. So there are questions from the audience.
How do you balance authenticity with consumer palates and understanding when it comes to naming and product descriptors?
Yeah. So we'd look at a couple of different things. We mentioned like customer testing. We'd also look at menus in terms of where the product was in, where we took inspiration from for that product. So because that's essentially what customers are seeing when they're not shopping at Tesco or within supermarkets. That's what they're associating with that dish or with that flavour profile. So what's happening kind of more broadly in the market in terms of what we're aspiring to, but also what is the traditional naming for that product? We'll do a bit of testing. Do customers understand it? Does it resonate? Do they associate it with that cuisine, etc.? And almost bring all of that together to kind of come up with a product description that we think fits from a brand perspective, but also from a cuisine perspective as well.
It's a tough one because it's trying to figure out. Customers can say kimchi, and that doesn't scare them. It might be maybe the fermenting that scares them, but it's knowing, you know,
it's crazy, right?
Fat family kind of being like, oh, if they can pronounce Swarovski, they can pronounce whichever, but there's certain things that sometimes
it's as simple, like we've changed the name of our, we sell a Spanish omelette, we always called it a Spanish omelette, we've called it a tortilla now. It's like the classic, you know, back in the day at M&S, Vichyssoise, we were M&S, so we were going to launch Vichyssoise soup. Nobody bought it.
Yeah.
Let's change the name to potato and leek. Biggest seller. Yeah. It is. But the kimchi is the perfect. I just don't understand how people have just latched. Yeah. I think it's because it's a lovely sounding word. But as simple as that.
I think for me, there's not one size fits all. And also, these things are very dynamic. I think you can't just say, because we've printed this month's packaging, we're never going to change it. I think you have to sort of understand the journey that your consumers are being taken on. And that can be, you know, if suddenly an ingredient is introduced on Bake Off, millions of people might suddenly be introduced to an ingredient, and it might change the understanding of a word or a cuisine, or if someone, Jamie Oliver used an ingredient or Nigella used an ingredient. So I think for me, my advice would be don't think of it as dynamic. It needs to be thought of as constantly evolving.
Yeah.
And consumers' expectations change, their understanding changes, and you as a brand have a responsibility to be in tune with that, I would say.
Thank you.
Okay, well, thanks to Jermaine, thank you to Matthew, and I hope you have a great rest of the day here. Thanks.
Cheers, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome.
Thank you for listening. If this has whet your appetite for next year's Food Matters live events, you can already register your interest to partner with us in London and Rotterdam. Just head to foodmatterslive.com.